Tax Committee this morning. We have an agenda in your packet. We actually have our first bill up for consideration and a vote today. I'm hoping we're going to set a very good precedent in the Tax Committee with a bipartisan vote in support of a federal conformity bill. It is Senate File 47, and we will begin with just a brief explanation. I'll start since this is a bill that I have introduced. Member, Senate File 47 allows federal conformity. In the Obama health care bill, there was a provision that would have mandated the accessibility of health care coverage for dependents 26 and under. And along with that provision was a provision that should be deductible from a participant's income. The reason we're taking this up today is that we have some timing issues. The deductibility is retroactive to 2010 tax liability. So because we want to allow our employers to get their W-2s out so that they can record imputed income correctly, we need to pass this bill on the Senate floor and off to the House and to the governor right away so Minnesotans can have the same tax treatment as other members across the country who will be paying these taxes. So, members, with that, we have Dan Lee, the Director of Withholding Division, Minnesota Department of Revenue, who will give us a little bit more information and answer any questions you have. We also have Pam Dahlstrom, who's the Director of Individual Income Tax, and Todd Cook, a CPA from John A. Knutson & Company. And if the three of you would like to come forward, and we'll take all of your testimony, and then we'll ask questions if the members will allow. Welcome to the Tax Committee. We'll begin with Mr. Lee. And if you would state your name for the record, we're recording, so if you would oblige us.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Dan Lee, Director of Withholding Tax Division for the Department of Revenue.
My name is Pam Dahlstrom. I'm the Director of Individual Income Tax for the Department of Revenue.
Thank you for having us this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Lee.
I think that you did a very nice job of summarizing the bill and the reason why it's on the table at this point in time. It is in fact time sensitive. We have not too much to offer in support of this bill, other than the fact that we are in fact highly supportive of it. This is a provision that would add, for lack of a better word, imputed income to the taxable wages of Minnesotans who have an adult child who is now covered under an employer health care provision. It adds complexity for employers and employees alike. As you probably know, and tax administrators typically default towards simplicity when given an option unless there's some compelling reason otherwise, and certainly this is no different. We have had many, many questions and concerns, comments expressed to us from members of the tax professional community, both accountants and attorneys, employers and other payroll professionals, about the issues associated with handling the compensation issues for employees who are affected by this if action is not taken to cure the conformity issue with the federal government. The issues that they have talked to center on how to report the difference in wages for Minnesota and for federal purposes, how to report or how to determine the amount of the difference, valuing the health care coverage that's provided for the employee dependent, issues around implementation. The employers typically have, especially larger employers, have software that they utilize for payroll reporting purposes, and that software needs to be adjusted to accommodate this difference. And I think that in many cases they're thinking that the likelihood is that they would be reversing those changes, so it's a costly change for employers. And there is confusion about how to handle forms W-2, which was so aptly described, that the W-2s are due to be furnished by employers to employees by January 31st. And I think that to the extent that those W-2s have not been submitted for employee purposes, that employers would like to be able to furnish a W-2 form to them that reflects the income that they will actually be reporting.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Ms. Dahlstrom?
Madam Chair, members, I want to echo what Dan has said, but I also want to talk about this from the point of an individual taxpayer. By nonconforming to this provision, we're adding considerable complexity for all types of taxpayers, from the lower income all the way up to the higher income. In order to comply with this particular statute at this point, taxpayers would have to complete two additional forms or schedules when they're filing their M-1, and making sure that they get the computation right. So it adds considerable complexity to their returns, and oftentimes they'll have to get additional help in order to make those calculations. So it's not an easy calculation, and I do encourage that we I do want to say that we support this bill and hope that it passes so that we can create a simplified form for the taxpayers.
Thank you, Ms. Dahlstrom. Is Mr. Cook here? Mr. Cook, would you like to come forward and address the committee?
Good morning. My name is Todd Cook. I'm a representative of the Minnesota Society of CPAs. I'm also a practicing CPA. I'm a tax partner in a local CPA firm here with about 30 people. We really appreciate the fact that you're looking at some of these conformity issues now. It is very important that people know actually how to prepare returns, what the rules are going to be for us to go down the route of preparing federal returns and then saying, well, the Minnesota rules may change later. We have to see what's going to happen at the legislature. It's very difficult for people. Either they cannot get their returns filed timely, or we'll look at maybe amended returns later. And a lot of times with amended returns later, frankly, they just don't happen. For either the fact that the taxpayer is doing their own return, either they don't know about the change or, frankly, they don't believe it's worth their time, or, frankly, people don't want to pay me to do an amended return. And I can surely understand that. And I'd rather do it right up front and get everything square up front. So we really appreciate that you're looking at this now. This is very timely. I was dealing with a client with this yesterday, in fact. So if we can help them figure out how to get everything done so everyone can get their returns in time, that would be very appreciated. I'd just like to take the time, too, just to, if you're going to do other conformity issues, too, the sooner you can do them, the better for everybody. Some of the conformity issues are very, very costly, and we understand that. Depreciation would be very, very costly. $250 teacher's deduction probably doesn't cost the state a whole lot of money, but would sure simplify the people's returns that are affected by those type provisions. And there's all kinds of things in between. You know, there's somewhere between 20 and 30 different variations of conformity right now, depending on where you're going down. And keep in mind that an increased cost of compliance is the same thing as a tax increase to the people of Minnesota. We want to keep the cost of complying with rules as low as possible, be it the cost to the state for having to have these people here learn two different sets of rules and re-educate people for differences, or the cost to for people paying me to keep up on all the stuff. Yes, I'm one of the few people you're ever going to hear asking to be paid less, not more. If we can get the cost of doing returns lower, that's better for everybody. So I really appreciate you looking at this now, and we really appreciate that you're looking at more conformity issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Koch, and you're always welcome here. You're among friends. We all seem to love tax issues, so I hope you'll always come back. For the members, this is not our only conformity bill that we'll have. We're taking this one up right now because our employers need to deal with these W-2s, but there were some other changes that were made by Congress in the lame duck session. Frankly, that our Department of Revenue is still working through some of the analysis on that and how do we extend those benefits to Minnesotans. So there will be another federal conformity bill. We just need to act on this one quickly, and I would appreciate your support in helping us get this done. There is going to be a technical amendment to this bill today, and Ms. Allen will talk about that. But first, I've asked her to describe the fiscal note that you will find in your packet And for new members, we're going to take just a few minutes so she can describe how these notes are prepared and so you can understand the information that's being provided to you. So it says at the top, Minnesota Revenue. And Ms. Allen, if you would, just describe what's happening with this document and how members might be able to make them useful.
Madam Chair and members, this is pretty standard what we'll see for revenue estimates going out. The department will give you the bill name and numbers and the authors, and then the cost. If you'll look at this estimate under fiscal year 2011, that's the only cost because we're only conforming in this bill for tax year 2010. If we were conforming ongoing, there would be ongoing costs in the various fiscal years. And then the department gives a brief description of the bill. As you can see, it talks about what the law was in place before and what the changes. And then under revenue analysis detail, usually the department will give a brief description of how they came to these numbers. Usually in things like this where it's federal conformity, they just take an apportioned amount of the cost that's been prepared by the Joint Committee on Taxation.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. Members, any questions for our testifiers or for Ms. Allen about this fiscal note? Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, the way I read it, this really only applies to those health care benefits October, November, December of 2010. Why, if this is a good idea, why wouldn't we do this going forward for the next fiscal year also? I'm a little confused if we think that this provision of the Obamacare health care bill was a good idea and we want to conform with federal law relative to taxability, and I think we all agree with that. Why wouldn't we do it for the next biennium? Why would we just chip away and take 3 months of it?
Senator Bach, excuse me. I think that's a fair enough question. The purpose of this bill was so specific. We didn't want to get into the long-term issues. We want to deal with this immediately. We are going to have another conformity bill. It would seem appropriate at that point to extend this going forward at that point. But perhaps Mr. Lee would like to address the question.
It's very, Madam Chair, Senator, it's very, very true. I believe going forward we would be supportive of conformity throughout time. There has been a fiscal analysis, I believe, that has been set forward. The financial consequences of doing this for 2010 so that employers can complete their W-2s is really the compelling reason for separating 2010 and looking at this alone at this time.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Lee, are there other tax provisions for 2010 that the legislature has not conformed with that maybe could be included in this? Or is this the only one we haven't conformed with for tax year 2010?
Senator Bach, as I said, the Department of Revenue is working on other law changes that were adopted by the lame duck Congress at the very end of the session and haven't sorted through all the analysis and whether or not some of that would be retroactive to 2010. The issue we're dealing with today is the W-2s. Those have to be issued by the end of this month. We've got some other time to deal with some of those other issues, but for now, this is our pressing issue, and frankly, that's why I thought this bill would be easily supported and on its way here this morning. But
well, Madam Chair, I'm not saying I don't support it. I'm just asking if there are other conformity issues. I mean, it's more than a W-2 issue. People are going to start doing their returns. Accountants are going to start doing their returns. And if we think doing federal conformity is important, and we've passed early bills before relative to federal conformity, and they cost money, and we figure out sometimes later, you know, how we're going to pay for them. But I know Senator Scoy has frequently times brought up the 179 expensing issue. I've heard the Republican caucus talk about how they want to create jobs and help businesses. Seems like something we might want to consider. Madam Chair, this committee spends a lot of money, and if we can spend it in a way that helps the business community, gives them a little extra money to help reinvest, and it's simply a conformity issue. And we're going to talk about conformity. I thought maybe we might want to at least know what else is out there, because I don't know what the other issues are that we haven't conformed to.
Senator Bach, I know there are provisions about adoption and there are provisions for depreciation. Our department hasn't been ready to speak authoritatively on those issues and give us guidance, but perhaps Mr. Lee or Ms. Dahlstrom could speak to any of those other conformity issues that they're looking into at this point.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Dahlstrom.
Senator, in fact, there are several other items that we are not conforming to, and they do add complexity to the return, the teacher and education expenses that we talked about earlier, depreciation 179. There are a number of areas. The department is not prepared at this time to discuss those, but they will be coming. The matter at this point is that we need to get the W-2s out to the employees, and taxpayers are starting to file their returns, and this is a particular one that is very concerning to both the department and the taxpayer.
Thank you, Ms. Dahlstrom. Mr. Lee, did you have a comment on that?
Madam Chair, no, I do not.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Buck, you opened your comment saying if we thought that Obamacare was a good thing, this would be something that we should support. And then you got into the timing factor of the bill, or the scope of the timing factor. But I would imagine that I'm safe in saying that some of us who are going to support this bill doesn't necessarily mean that we are in support of the federal Obamacare health care programs that were passed. In no way does that support of this particular provision mean that we're supporting Obamacare. It means that we're recognizing a tax deduction that's available to our citizens as a result of the Obamacare. And that's what the scope of this bill is. And I think it would, I don't agree with your framing the debate that because we support this, we support Obamacare. That is not true. So I just want to lay it on the table that some of us are in opposition to Obamacare, but this is an available tax credit or a deduction.
It's a deduction.
Deduction that's available to our people. And if we're forced to accept Obamacare, then we should go after these tax deductions.
Senator
Bach, I just wanted to comment, Senator Limmer, that we want to make sure that Minnesotans have the same tax treatment, and Obamacare is current federal law. And I think that's the reality that we face as a Senate and in the tax committee is to say exactly that. If other citizens in other states across the country have the same tax benefit, we should have it here in Minnesota. And I think it would be unusual if we decided that they wouldn't. But Senator Bach, you wanted to comment on that, and then Senator Michelle.
Well, Madam Chair, I think you're encouraging Obamacare, and this provision isn't as a result of Obamacare. This was specifically part of it. They intentionally made this health benefit tax deductible as part of the program. It wasn't a result of Obamacare. I mean, they specifically said this health benefit should not be taxed, and I think they're right. But I don't think, Senator Limmer, it's fair to say it's a result of Obamacare. It was part of it to make this extension of health benefits non-taxable. And apparently we're probably all agreeing here that that's a good idea.
Well, and Senator Bach, just one moment, Senator Limmer. When it comes to that, the federal law actually expanded the requirements for availability of health care premiums to be paid up through age 26. Previous law prior to that, I think, was 21. And so that was 24. Mr. Lee would know. Or Ms. Dahlstrom.
Madam Chair, it was 19 or 24.
19 or 24. So there you have it. So the change in federal law was to require that it be available up through age 26. And one of the trade-offs was let's make those health care premiums deductible to the person carrying the insurance and being asked to expand to provide those services. So what this bill does is it makes that premium now deductible under federal law to Minnesotans as well. Senator Lennon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Buck, maybe we're parsing hairs a little close here, but if we didn't have an Obamacare, or if the governor did not enroll us into an early Obamacare enrollment, we wouldn't need this. So this is a direct result of Obamacare being passed by the federal government and the governor signing us into early enrollment. That's a fact.
Well,
Senator Michelle, well, Senator Bach, maybe you want to continue here.
Senator Limmer, we don't have to do this. Obamacare didn't tell us we have to do this. It just says that if we do this, people will have that benefit treated as tax-free. That's all. I mean, it's nothing we have to. You're right, Senator Limmer, nothing we have to do. But there are some tax advantages to doing it to Minnesotans, and that's why the bill is here.
Senator Michelle.
Well, Madam Chair, there's nothing like a good Obamacare discussion to wake us up, and I don't mean to stop that, but I think the more important question in front of the committee was, what can we work on now? What do we need to work on now for conformity, and what else may be out there in the next couple months? And my sense from his earlier testimony and his leaning towards the microphone was that Mr. Koch had some more thoughts as to what may be out there that we will need to deal with as a legislature this coming session, and I wanted to make sure we give him a chance to.
Good point, Senator Michelle. Mr. Koch.
Madam Chair, there are close to 30 differences. Some of them would add revenue to the Minnesota coffers, and most would take away. One that would add money to the coffers I could speak about because it's one that impacts me. Right now, for federal purposes, for the first time, I can deduct my health insurance and reduce my self-employment tax for a one-year deal. So I am treated like a regular corporation. I'm a partner in a partnership. But because Minnesota didn't adopt that provision, I'm going to get to deduct a higher self-employment tax against my Minnesota income, even though I don't have to pay it. Seems a little, I'll take it if you want to give it to me, but it seems like something we should conform with. So that's an example of a change that would add revenue to the coffers. But most of the changes, however, would take revenue from the coffers. That would be at the tuition deduction, be at the teacher's deduction. There are issues with some of the adoption expenses. There's a separate form that the department has put together that lists out, I believe, 23 differences that existed when the form was created, and then due to the lateness of the Congress acting, there's some additional ones that are also have to be included too. So we'd encourage you, whatever you could do as early as you can to do it. One reason to deal with this today, and maybe we have a window to deal with the rest a little later, is that, again, due to Congress's lateness in action, the Internal Revenue Service has to reprogram their computers. Because they have to reprogram their computers, most people can't file their federal returns until late February, somewhere between the middle and end of February. Yes, there are some people that are filing today, and the people that are filing today are people who are not, by and large, are not impacted by the other differences. So if you deal with it in the next few weeks, actually, everybody will know the rules by the time most of the people impacted would file. This provision today, however, could impact a wider audience, make things easier for employers to figure out. I was dealing with a client yesterday. We were trying to figure out how to deal with this provision. I was able to fortunately tell them, well, let's talk about it on Monday. We might have an idea if we have to continue to worry about it, which they were very glad to hear. So by dealing with this now, I appreciate looking at it as an isolated issue that we can get it passed timely, so that the Minnesota taxpayers can get their information timely so they can file their tax returns as timely as possible. The other issues, most people that are going to be impacted by those other issues cannot file due to Congress until the middle to end of February anyhow.
Thank you, Mr. Cope. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're going to deal with this W-2 issue today. Does the department have a feel for when it's going to be able to provide the committee with additional information on these other 20 or 30 non-conforming issues that are out there? And the timeline I'm thinking about should be in February at the very latest, but I was wondering what, if you have any thoughts on that.
Ms. Dahlstrom or Mr. Lee?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't know at this time when the department will be prepared. I can certainly check into that and get that information back to you.
Madam Chair, I would hope that you would encourage the department to be moving on that sooner rather than later.
Well, Senator Sko, I think they've heard us, and they know that we want to know as much as we can, as soon as we can, and we will get that information out to members right away. When those bills come forward, I'll make sure that other folks have a chance to look at them as well. Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, I just want to be clear that none of the other nonconformity issues deal with W-2s then. Is that correct?
Mr. Lee.
Chair, Senator, to the best of my knowledge, there are no other conformity issues that deal with W-2, which essentially is just a different way of saying employee taxable wages.
Right.
So maybe cast in those terms, that would be true.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Howell. Well, at this point, if there is no further discussion, Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I mean, does anybody, and I wouldn't know because I don't know what the other body's doing, but does anybody in this room think that this is going to get signed into law before January 31st, before the mandatory date the W-2s have to go out? I mean, aren't W-2s being prepared right now? Certainly before the Senate can pass this, the House can pass it, the message can come back, it can get enrolled and sent to the governor. I can't imagine how this becomes law before the 31st, and even if it became law the 31st, aren't all the W-2s gone under current law? Don't they all have to be sent out? I mean, are we just kind of kidding ourselves here that somehow employers are sitting holding on W-2s waiting for the legislature to act on this? I mean, I think just a little honest discussion about is how many W-2s is really going to impact in the state.
Senator Bach, thank you for the question. We have a technical amendment that addresses your concerns, at least in part. It is the A1 amendment that is being handed out, and when they've come around, Ms. Allen will discuss the technical change.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the A1 amendment is a technical amendment. The first three lines removes one of the references to the federal laws because it isn't necessary for this provision for conformity, and then the additional Section 2 does in part address the concern raised by Senator Bach about the W-2s. It would not require employers who have already issued W-2s to reissue corrected ones.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. Any questions about the intention of the amendment or the language?
But Madam Chair, if
Senator Bach.
I have my W-2 and it's not accurate. If I prepare my own tax return, how would I know that the law has changed? I mean, I have the Department of Revenue's booklet. It says that this is a taxable benefit. It's on my W-2. How is the Department of Revenue then going to flag these returns and correct them? Or I mean, the taxpayer that files their own return isn't going to know that their W-2 is not accurate. But does the department somehow correct people's returns that have been filed inaccurately based on their, I mean, they did it based on their best information in the tax booklet and on their W-2. How does the taxpayer that files their own return take advantage of the tax benefit?
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach. there are a wide range of circumstances that we'll encounter. One of the things we're hoping is that if there is early passage of this bill, that employers will know which of their employees are affected by this, and perhaps they can help us communicate with the employees so that they will know what to report. In all but a handful of cases, we believe that the employee will have the information available to them to report accurately because of the way that we have asked employers to report this information. The federal wages are reported in one box on Form W-2. The state wages are reported in a separate box. If employers have done what we have instructed them to do, the wages in the state box will include the value of the added health coverage, but that would not be included in the federal wages. So all an employee would need to do would simply be to use the federal wages rather than the state wages when they complete their return. Actually, as kind of a side note, I believe that some employers have probably not or don't intend to comply with our request of them in terms of reporting simply because of the cost of doing so. So in some cases, a W-2, if this was enacted, would be accurate across the board. So, but there's a very wide range of circumstances in terms of what employees would be expected to do. For those who actually would file a paper return that has a W-2 attached, it ought to have enough information that the department could, in fact, correct it if we chose to do. When employees file in an electronic fashion, we're subject to the information that they actually include at the time that they file the return until later when we go back using the information that employers have provided to us and make correction at that time. And just as a, it doesn't make a great deal of difference, but the forms W-2 are required to be furnished to the employee by January 31st. They are required to be filed with the Department of Revenue by February 28th. So there's actually two different dates, and this would facilitate the filing of correct W-2 forms with the Department of Revenue, even if incorrect W-2 forms had been provided to employees.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lee. And as Mr. Koch has said, the CPAs are watching this. Employers are watching this issue, and the department is watching to make sure as many taxpayers know about this as possible, and we're moving it as quickly as we can. And I would hope that the risk that we might not get to every taxpayer wouldn't keep us from adopting a change like this, which is so important and could benefit so many Minnesotans. So with that, first, Senator Bach, I would ask that we adopt the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to the bill as it's been introduced. That doesn't require a vote, and so if the committee doesn't disagree, it will become an author's amendment, and the A1 is adopted. Senator Marty and then Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, just
gonna vote on it?
Technical question on the amendment for Senate Council, includable. Does Department of Revenue, or do we use that as a word? I understand what it apparently means. I've just never heard it used as a word.
I'm sorry, Senator Marty, the word includable?
Includable. I was just curious for Senate Council.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, that was the language suggested by the department.
Senator Marty, any more comment on that? Thank you. Members, forgive me for the error. We need to go back and vote on the A1 amendment, and I hope that members would extend the courtesy. As I said, we're trying to put the bill in the shape that I think it should proceed in. And so with that, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And all those opposed, same sign. Now it's adopted. Thank you, members, and I apologize for the error. Any other questions or comments about discussion about the Senate File 47 before we move that bill as well? And I would entertain a motion to move that bill to the floor. So moved by Senator Limmer. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my first knowledge of this issue was an email from my son, who's a CPA. And he's responsible for doing payroll for his employer, probably, I don't know, a couple hundred employees maybe. And he raised the issue with me a week ago if we were going to do this or not. So, Madam Chair, I told him I didn't know. It depended on what it would cost. I'd like to email him back. What should I tell him? I don't know. I don't know what the situation is over in the other body. But I mean, he sincerely wanted to know what he should do with his W-2s. He has to prepare them and send them out. He's a pretty responsible kid. That's why he contacted me to find out he can get it right. Is there something I can tell him?
Senator Bach, perhaps our CPA or someone from the Department of Revenue can answer your question. Mr. Koch.
I understand that W-2s can be issued any time during January. As a practical matter, however, most of them come out that last week in January because people are waiting until they can match everything together properly. And with year-end, all the other year-end issues they have to deal with, I send out request letters to my clients that they have to get stuff ready for me so I can help them prepare their taxes. It tends to come out very late in January, it meaning the W-2s. So there is, yes, while some have been issued already, the majority will tend to be later. And I do know, if I remember right, the House took the same matter up on Tuesday, I believe. So it is, it's kind of migrating its way through. But I appreciate your concern that if we change something that nobody can use, what did we accomplish? But by dealing with this as early as we can, the majority of people who take care of giving the W-2s to their employees, is generally that last week in January.
Thank you, Mr. Koch. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and probably to the department. I think it was a school district that contacted me with this issue, and they had prepared all their W-2s, and they weren't sent out yet, and they were asking me if they were going to have to redo all their W-2 forms or not. And after the A-1 amendment was adopted here, I'm curious if I should just call them back and say, well, go ahead and send them out because you wouldn't have to do a corrected one, or would I be wiser to call them back and tell them to redo all their W-2s? I'm curious as to how that's going to work for these because, you know, this is all kind of in transition now. And this distributed word in the bill now is, I think, going to be an issue. And I'm wondering what you should tell those folks. Anybody got any advice for me?
Mr.
I know they haven't been sent out today, but they certainly could go out next week before this is signed into law, and then they wouldn't have to redo all their W-2s, which is what the issue that they didn't want to have to redo.
Madam Chair, Senator Scully, it's kind of a tough call, I think. I would probably recommend that if they have not sent them, that they hold them if they believe that they're prepared to be able to issue corrected forms, depending upon the action on this particular bill. Again, regardless of whether the W-2 forms have been issued or not, we're hoping, we intend to prepare a communication plan here shortly so that as soon as we have the go-ahead, we're able to contact affected employers and through other associations such as the American Payroll Association, the Minnesota Society of CPAs, the Minnesota Association of Public Accountants, those types of organizations, that they'll have the information that they need to be able to file accurate tax returns with or without amended forms W-2. We have another issue from a Department of Revenue perspective around the filing of amended forms W-2, and that simply has to do with the volume of documents that we would need to process. And again, since the original form W-2, hopefully if the employers are following our request, would have sufficient information to answer that question for the employee either way, we should be all right without the W-2. So it relieves the employer of an added burden and actually facilitates our work at the Department of Revenue as well.
Thank you, members. Senate Counsel Ms. Allen is suggesting another technical amendment that she will read to us. It will be an oral amendment. Ms. Allen.
Madam Chair, to the A-1 amendment, page 1, after line 10, insert effective date. This section is effective the day following final enactment. So that would require the W-2 provision to be effective now rather than in August.
I'd move that as an oral amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Michelle moves the oral amendment as read by Ms. Allen. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Ms. Dahlstrom, on January 1st, okay, where we currently are now, payroll this week, this is a taxable benefit. So how do employers treat it? Because we're not conforming for current payroll period. We're only conforming for back 2010. How do employers treat this relative to their payroll this week? I mean, does the tax liability, if we never conform in 2011, and are the payroll taxes withheld on this benefit on a weekly basis, or do the taxes just accrue, and then when somebody receives their W-2, it shows up as a taxable benefit where no payroll taxes have been withheld, and then do they have some back withholding issues when they file their 2011 return?
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I'll take this one. We have advised employers that they are not required to withhold on the incremental value of health insurance for 2011. Frankly, the reason for that is that we're hopeful that those provisions will be adopted going forward. If in fact the session passes and those provisions have not been adopted for 2011, at that point in time we would intend to advise employers to begin withholding on the value of the health insurance. I don't think that we would ask them to go back and reevaluate the wages that had already been paid and the withholding associated with that and make a correction, although employees can always make an adjustment on their own to be able to add withholding if they want to ensure that they don't end up with a surprise come tax return filing time.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. And Senator Limmer has made a motion to recommend passage of Senate File 47 and send it to the Senate floor. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I had one question of the appropriate age here because I thought the federal benefits were up till age 26. The Department of Revenue's fiscal note mentions under age 27, which includes age 26. The amendment includes that. And I'm wondering, because I think the federal health care benefit only extends to children up, including 25, but not including 26. And the department's fiscal note, if so, is such, and the technical amendment uses the term 27. And I'm wondering what is the correct year.
Ms. Allen.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, it's my understanding it's up through 26, so until your last day of being 26, so under 27. That's the way I've seen it. I can double check on that for you, but that's what I've seen through the department as well as from other sources.
Okay. Madam Chair, you may be correct. I was just curious because I was thought it was up till 26, but not in through 26.
I think it is.
Senator Marty, I also have seen in all the documentation through age 26. Senator Limmer renews his motion for Senate File 47 to be, as amended, to be recommended to pass and referred to the Senate floor. Any other comments? Senator Limmer, do you want to speak in favor of the motion, or should we just vote?
Time to vote.
All right. Members, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
And all those opposed, say no. The amendment or the bill, as amended, is recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. Thank you, members. Thank you to the testifiers, and we'll look forward to the rest of the information you have for us on conformity whenever it's available to us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, last week we were not able to complete the overview of the tax committee's jurisdiction and the major sources of revenue that come to the state, and at this point we are going to take up a review of tax aids and credits, and Mr. Ouellette from Property Tax Division from the Department of Revenue is here. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Ouellette.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Ouellette with the Property Tax Research Division of the Department of Revenue. Let me just get this going. Let me start with a little bit of a brief background about property tax research. We provide the revenue estimates for property tax bills that you will hear. We try to estimate what the state and local impacts are of proposals to change the laws regarding property taxes and state aids and credits. Revenue estimates for all other tax types are done by Dr. Paul Wilson's group, the Tax Research Division. And you'll probably have occasion to meet him at some point here in the session if you have not already. So we have two different work units. We focus on property tax and state aids. We also work with legislative staff to establish guidelines for how we model property tax impacts. Those of you who have been around for a while are aware of this, but it's an important group that meets regularly to agree on standards for how we estimate impacts so that when you get information from your staff or from the department, it's as consistent as it can be. I want to just real briefly mention for the newer members that one of the things that you'll see on revenue estimates for property tax items is something called interaction costs. When there is a bill that changes local property taxes, there can be indirect state revenue impacts, because higher homestead property taxes can increase the cost of the property tax refund program. Lower property taxes can save money in the property tax refund. And the amount that businesses and residents can deduct on their income taxes for property taxes paid can also change with local property taxes. So there are both income tax interactions and property tax refund interactions that you'll see on our revenue estimates. If you have any questions about how these work, please feel free to give us to contact me or talk to your staff about it. I just wanted to flag that, because that is something that some people may not expect when they're preparing legislation to change local property taxes. There's also a new feature on the revenue estimates this year that I just briefly wanted to mention. Part of the omnibus tax bill last year required that for property tax proposals only, we provide some information on the revenue estimate about how the proposal changes the characteristics of the property tax system in terms of how transparent it is, how competitive it makes Minnesota businesses, and some other things dealing with property tax principles. We have a sheet that I think is in your packet that attempts to describe this new item. I just wanted to flag it for you, partly because it is new, so there's probably going to be a lot of questions about it, and we're still working with your staff and the House staff to figure out exactly how we're going to do it to ensure that we're consistent in how we implement this. So bear with us. This is a new thing, and please give us feedback on it as well so we can make sure. The goal of this new requirement is to provide you not only the numbers on the impact, but also whether your proposal changes the nature of the property tax system for the good or for the bad. With that, I will. I wanted to start with just a couple of visuals on background on the property tax system before we get into the aids and credits, which is the meat of my presentation. The first chart shows market value trends by major property class over the last 10 years or so. This is important because the assessed value is really the first step in the property tax system. When values of property change at different rates than the property tax levies that are levied by local governments, some of those can shift from one property type to another. A classic example is when a big downtown's commercial real estate market has a downturn, that can shift taxes into the neighborhoods, onto the residences, and vice versa when there's strong growth in value in the downtown. More recently, we've seen this phenomenon in the agricultural areas where the value of agricultural land has continued to climb while other property type values have leveled off or even gone down. So we're seeing some tax shifting out of the towns and cities and into the farm areas. I would point out, too, that in 2009 we saw a real spike in taxable value in agriculture, and many of you heard from some of your constituents about that, and that was coupled with declines or lower increases in other property types, so that did cause quite a bit of shifting. And these are the assessment years for the taxes payable the following year, so that was taxes payable last year, the 2009 assessment values. And if you have any questions as I go along, please interrupt me. The second slide shows the second major component of property taxes. You start with the assessed value, but then
Madam
you have
Chair.
The levies that are.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Senator Skoy.
Thank you. Mr. Ouellette, back to that other slide. The ag land, did you really experience that kind of percent change from in just this last year? I was surprised to see that.
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, this is the taxable value. This was a combination of very strong ag sales in the southwestern and western part of the state, along with the phase-out of the limited market value program, which took a lot of already existing value that was not taxed and put it back on the tax rolls. And then there was a third factor where the green acres value for the 10% of properties that were in the green acres program went up. So that increased taxable values as well. The overall estimated market value didn't go up quite that much.
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, yeah, I understand the 2009 number. The one I don't understand is the 2010 number. Why that significant downturn there?
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair, I think this is a Senator Scoia. I think this is a combination of there is still continued strong growth in the farm. The further away from the metro area you get, but the estimated market values for the farmland around the metro area, where a lot of that value is because of development pressure, those have continued to go down. So there's kind of two different stories going on here. The agricultural values are still going up. The taxable value for those lands where there's a lot of development pressure are not going up nearly as quickly. And there's also this includes the 2B land, which is the sort of rural lands, and that's not going up as much either.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Ouellette.
Levies by jurisdiction. What you see here is the trend of property tax levies since 1996, and I would point out just a couple of things with this chart in the interest of time. There's a whole lot of stories in this chart, but one of the main takeaways from this chart is the impacts of the 2001 big plan reforms if you compare 2001 to 2002 calendar years. Very, very large decreases in school levies. That was the linchpin of the big plan. And the establishment of a state property tax on businesses and cabins. The state had not levied a property tax since 1968, but it got back into property taxes in 2002 as a way to complete the package of the big plan reforms. And there were also reductions to local government aids as part of that deal. So that major change is one of the stories in this chart. A second story is that the rate of increase since the big plan is steeper than it was prior to the big plan. Property taxes, at least up until a couple years ago. Prior to the big plan, the 8 years prior, the average increase was about 4% overall. After the big plan through about 2008, we were looking at 7.5% total increases in property taxes. A lot of that increase in slope is due to school referendum levies being passed at a greater rate. Another factor was the years of aid cuts to local governments, and some of that was translated into higher property taxes by cities and counties. Finally, I think the third tale here is that the last couple of years since the 2008 recession, increases have been much more modest than historical standards. Overall, in 2010, I think around 3.5% the last couple of years, although I failed to write that number down. This is another way to look at it and sort of segues into what we're going to be talking about with aids and credits. Reliance on state revenues as opposed to property taxes varies significantly by jurisdiction type and from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. This shows the trend since 1990 of how much state revenues were as a share of total revenues for different types of local government. You'll see schools at the top much more reliant on state aid, less reliant on local owned source resources. And that is especially peaked right after the big plan, where school levies were taken over by state aids. So they were up to 75% state revenues, 25% other revenues at that time. And it's declined a little bit since then because of all these levy referendums that have been passed by some school districts. There's going to be quite a bit of variation from one district to another, one city or town to another, but these are the overall averages. And then the story for cities and counties has been a steady decline in the last 20 years of state revenues as a percent of the total. That doesn't mean a decline in real dollars, but it means as a share of the total, state revenues have declined for both cities and counties, especially for cities. Finally, one last chart. This is a little bit of a complicated chart, but I think it's useful to keep in mind as we talk about aids and credits. Minnesota has a pretty complicated property tax system, and there are a lot of different ways to change property tax burdens. And what this shows is by these major class types, how the state is divided up by a couple of measures. On the left is estimated market value. This is assessors' estimates of what all the property would sell for in the open market. The red box on the top is property that's exempt from taxation, so it only shows up in the first box. But then you see business being the orange and residential being the blue. When you take away exempt value, then you get to taxable market value. What is available for taxation? What is the assessed value of that? And you'll see that's the second bar. The third bar is what's called net tax capacity, and that is our tax base after applying our classification system. We have a classified tax system where every dollar of value is taxed at a different rate depending on its use and ownership. Business property pays a higher property tax per dollar value than residential. Residential pays more per dollar value than ag, generally speaking. So after you apply those tax capacity rates, then you get our tax base, and you'll see how much business property jumps as a share of the total. Residential and ag goes down a little bit. That's the effect of our classification system. There's also other things that affect that, deferrals and other things that take value off the rolls. And then finally, we get the net tax incidence. That's after the levies are spread, after any credits are applied, after any refunds are applied. This is the ultimate burden, distribution of the payment of net taxes. And business again jumps up because this is where the state property tax is applied as an additional tax that the other property types don't pay. So the business share goes up yet again. Okay, so there's a lot of things that go on between each of these steps that change the incidence of the property tax. With that, I will jump into the aids and credits, and I will, in the interest of time, try to go quickly, if I'm going too fast or you have questions, please interrupt.
You're doing great, Mr. Ouellette. Thank you.
I've divided the aids and credits, property tax aids and credits is about 3.5 projected to be for the upcoming biennium about $3.5 billion of the state's budget. That's about 10% of the state's budget as it's currently projected according to the November forecast. I've divided these aids and credits into four really broad categories. The first is direct payments to individuals. The second is what we often the big general aids and credits that we talk about a lot in taxes. The third category is big aid programs that are categorical to one degree or another. And then the catch-all at the end is all the other miscellaneous aid and credit programs that are part of the aid and credit budget. The payments to individuals are about a third of the total. The big aid and credits are a little less than two-thirds. And then the other programs make up the 10% balance. This does not include state aids to schools. And if you're really thinking about how the state impacts property taxes, the conversation is not complete without a look at how we do aids to school districts. But that is beyond the scope of this presentation. So just to put it into context, school aids are projected to be about $14 billion for the upcoming biennium. So the aids and credits that we're going to talk about is $3.5 billion, school aids about $14 billion.
Madam Chair?
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ouellette, I have a friend who just got their rent credit slip to file, and it said 19% on the form instead of 15. Did they use an old form, or what is the status of the renter's credit for 2010?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, for the upcoming year, we are back to 19% under current law. The 15% was impact for the refunds that were paid last fall. But it was
for rent paid in calendar 2010.
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, we used the rent paid the previous year for the refunds that are paid in this year. So there's that lag in the calculation.
So Madam Chair, Mr. Ouellette, are those refunds then paid after July 1st?
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, yes, the rent refunds are generally paid in August, I believe, and the regular PTR is generally paid in September and October, I think, is where the bulk of the payments go out. So they're all in the next fiscal year.
And Senator Bach, my understanding is that form is due back in August, completed and sent back to the IRS.
But, Madam Chair, so my question becomes,
Department of Revenue.
The renter got the form, filled out, signed by their landlord, says 19% on it. They're going to submit their MPR1 or whatever the number is and attach their receipt. Is the department then going to correct all of them if this legislature decides to reduce the credit? or what kind of, how does that mechanically happen? Because the taxpayer is going to file for their refund based on the form that they received signed by their landlord. So how does that change get made?
Senator Bach, I think that's a very good question, and we are going to have another opportunity to look at it. And so maybe if Mr. Willett could get a little more information about this and bring it back. But Senator Roebling's bill addresses the renter's credit and that rate from 19 to 15%. And so we're going to talk about that again next week, and maybe we'll give Mr. Willett some time to prepare on that about what the department intends to do and the deadlines. Okay. Mr. Willett, we are short of time. There is a Rules Committee meeting at 10, so I want to give a chance for Mr. Willett to complete his
Madam Chair, I'll go into overdrive.
thank you.
There are four major payments to individual programs. The property tax refund to homeowners has about 400,000 annual claims. The property tax renter refund, about 300,000. The targeting refund is about 50,000. And then there's a payment to owners of forest land, the Sustainable Forest Investment Act, which has about 1,700. And on the right-hand side of this chart shows the page in your handout where the programs can be found if you want to read additional details about them. The homeowner property tax refund is income tested, so the higher your income, the less credit you will get. The maximum eligible income is just under $100,000. The maximum refund is for this upcoming year is just under $2,400. And the calculation is what is your property tax relative to your income. There's kind of a complicated table in the form, but as your income goes up or your property tax goes down, the amount of refund you're eligible for goes down as well. This program has grown very quickly compared to other aids and credits since 2002, annual growth of about 16%. Some of that was legislatively enacted. Some of it is a result of property taxes growing more quickly than incomes have grown since 2002. The renter property tax refund is also income tested. It's a refund to renters whose rents are high relative to income. We assume for the purposes of the program that their property taxes are 19% of whatever they pay in rent. There was a time, I believe, in the history of the program where they attempted to actually calculate rents at the parcel level, but this was done in an effort to streamline the administration of the program. Whether the 19% is right or not, there's been some discussion about that I assume will occur again next week, so I won't belabor that point.
Yes, and Mr. Willett, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the detailed information that you were referring to was not in your packet, but it will be distributed to the members.
Okay, and these are the budget pages from the Department of MMB that I'm referring to. The maximum refund, $1,500. Annual growth in this program has been 5% since 2002, so it has grown, but not nearly as quickly as the homeowner refund. And as Senator Bach alluded to, there was a one-time cut last year in the program of about $50 million by reducing the assumed percentage of rent to 15%. Targeting a refund is a much smaller program. It is not income tested, so this goes to any homeowner whose property tax has gone up by more than 12% year over year. The refund equals 60% of the increase over 12%, maximum refund of $1,000. This program is generally between $6 and $10 million a year. It's important to think about, though, if there are actions taken by the legislature that would create tax shocks at the local level, that could impact the cost of the targeting program in the short term. Sustainable Forest Incentive Act is a relatively new program that provides an incentive payment to owners of forested land if they follow good management practices for their forests. And for owners of large parcels, they're required to provide public access to their land, so the public gets a benefit in return. There was a glitch in this program that caused the cost of the program to spike starting last year. The per acre payment has nearly doubled because of a change in the formula that had an unintended consequence, which we can talk about if you'd like, or we can talk about at a later time. We hope that as a department that formula can be corrected this legislative session, so we can talk about that. And last year, as part of the budget balancing, there was a one-time cap put on the payments that no taxpayer would get more than $100,000, and that impacted, I believe, six large landowners. Most of the participants in this program do not the average return is several thousand dollars, so most were not impacted by that cap. Big general aid and credit programs. Local government aid to cities under current law will be about $1 billion for the biennium, $500 million a year. County program aid, about $200 million a year. And then the market value homestead credit and the market value agricultural land credit combined for about $600 million a year. And then a smaller program, the disparity reduction aid, is about $40 million a year. Local government aid to cities has been around since 1971. It has a complicated formula that compares each city's need, how much money they need to be able to provide a average level of service at an average tax price. And then it takes an accountability to pay how much tax base. Those cities that have a very strong tax base, the formula calculates that they can pay for their needs fully out of their local tax base and they receive no local government aid. Those that have weaker tax bases or higher needs will then receive LGA. It's a fixed pool. Then the amount is distributed based on the amount of needs that the formula comes up with. So all other things being equal, aid can shift from some cities to other cities each year as the formula recalculates need and ability to pay. The need formula is pretty complicated. There's actually two, one for cities over 2,500 population, one for cities under 2,500 population, which I can get into if you like, but I'll skip over it for now. The chart shows the appropriations over the last several years, and those green bars in four of the years are the occasions where cities were certified one level of LGA, but because of state budget reasons, it was cut, and they actually received less than they were certified to receive. County program aid is newer than local government aid. It was created in 2003. And it has basically two pots. Rather than comparing need and ability to pay, it distributes two pots to counties, one based on need, one based on ability to pay. Unlike local government aid, every county gets county program aid, and the amounts per capita, or however you want to measure it, are much more uniform for county program aid than for local government aid. There's less variation from one jurisdiction to another. And counties, too, have had three occasions where county program aid was reduced after certification.
Mr. Ouellette, very briefly, are there any limitations in either of those programs as to how the counties or cities can spend the funds or any kind of recommendations from the legislature at all about how they should be spent?
Madam Chair, both of these are general purpose aids. The formulas may give some clue as to what they're intended for, but they are general purpose aids, and exactly what the purpose of the programs is sometimes a source of confusion. Is it property tax relief? Is it state revenue sharing to help poor communities pay for services? It's probably a combination of both, but neither of them has a clear statement of purpose in statute that would give us a definitive answer.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I was wondering if...
I'm sorry, Senator Howell.
That's fine.
Sorry.
I was wondering, is there an Excel spreadsheet that we could get electronic version that would actually list down the cities and the counties? And I see you said that the counties are, the jurisdictions are pretty comparable, but for the cities they're not. So I was wondering, is there a spreadsheet that we could get electronically that would list those?
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I can provide that to you, or Jack Paulson from your staff also could provide that to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Howe. Mr. Ouellette.
Okay, market value homestead.
I'm sorry, Senator Skoy.
Thank you. Mr. Ouellette, when you were on the chart that had the bars with the yellow on top of them that showed the cuts, back in 2003 there was a cut after certification, but then the bar graphs show that the LGA never recovered back to the level that it had been paid out prior to 2003. Is my assumption right that if you used the formula and fully funded the formula, that the number would be closer to the $600 million number as opposed to where that bar graph shows it in 2004?
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, at the time that the 2003 cuts were enacted, the program was also permanently reduced in future years. So there were cuts to future year LGA at the same time. What I was trying to illustrate here were just the cuts that came after certification mid-year. But, yes, the program was permanently reduced at that time. So you could show cuts in 2004 and 2005 compared to what had been expected back in 2003. But at the time aides were certified in 2004, this is the amount they were told they were going to receive, and they actually did receive that amount of money. So that would be a different way to show it. The program was permanently reduced, partially restored in 2006, and then the cuts since then.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ouellette.
Market value homestead credit is a credit to the tax bill of homesteads across the state based on the value of the property. The chart shows what the value of the credit is at how much money you get from the credit at different values. It goes up to peaks at $304 at $76,000 of market value, and then as the value of the homestead goes up, the value of the credit goes down. This was created as part of the 2001 Big Plan reforms. And its structure was done in such a way to focus most of the tax relief to the lower valued homes that were not getting credit, that were not getting as much benefit from some other features of that tax reform package. So the benefit of this program goes to homesteads. It reduces the bottom line on the tax bill that they receive. However, because they're not paying that amount of tax, the amount of property taxes collected by the county and distributed to the local units of government is less than what they levied for. So the state, under this program, reimburses the local governments for the value of that credit. And it's those market value homestead credit reimbursements that have been reduced some years to local governments in budget balancing maneuvers. Important to know that when the reimbursements have been cut, the value of the credit to the homestead has not been affected. So the homestead gets gets the benefit of the program. The local government does not get reimbursed fully in the times when this has happened for that credit, and they have to make budget adjustments. Now, some jurisdictions, when this happened in successive years, increased their property tax levies with the expectation that they would not get the reimbursement. So then the taxpayers did end up paying indirectly for the failure to reimburse, but that would be all the taxpayers, not just the homesteads. So that would be the businesses and the apartments and the other properties that don't qualify for the reimbursement. There's a similar credit for agricultural land for agricultural homesteads, not the homestead of agricultural homesteads, but the agricultural land for agricultural homesteads. And unlike the homestead credit, this one does not phase out. It goes up and goes down depending on the value, and then it flattens out at what value? About $235 of value. And this is a much smaller program. There's about 100,000 agricultural homesteads in the state. So in terms of the budget impact, it's much smaller. But in terms of the dollars per taxpayer, it's a little bit higher than the market value credit. Finally, disparity reduction aid. This is the last of the sort of general purpose aids, and this is one of the most complicated things in the property tax aids and credits, and it's unfortunate that we're short of time because this is one that is very interesting. But let me just say that this is an aid that is was part of a previous property tax reform from 1988 when the state went from a market value-based system to a tax capacity-based system. And what it did was, when we made that switch, there were some jurisdictions, because of that property tax reform, that ended up with especially high local tax rates. And this aid was created to moderate those tax rates for those parts of the state that had the highest tax rates after that reform. One of the most unique parts of this program, though, is that it's not distributed at the jurisdiction level. It's distributed at what's called a unique taxing area level, which is a unique combination of an overlap of your school district, your city, county, city township boundaries, your watersheds, or whatever. So in this picture, I've shown sort of an idealized geography where you've got a city and a township and two school districts. One's the box in the upper left, and the other one is the remainder of it. And how disparity reduction aid works is it's applied to the tax rates in that, just in that square that might have the highest combination of school, city, and other tax rates. There's a lot of implications for having an aid that's at this level, and one of the implications is that it's very hard to make any changes to it without shifting taxes. So it's been a very, very stable program since 1988, but it's about $38 million for the biennium, about $19 million a year. It has gone down, declined a little bit since its creation, as some of these areas have had their tax rates lowered, so they no longer qualify for the aid. Okay, how am I doing for time? There's also some relatively large programs that are more categorical in nature that are part of property tax aids and credits. The two big ones are police aid and fire aid. These are used to the way the state helps local governments pay for the pension costs for the employer contributions to pension costs for police and fire services. These are both funded indirectly through insurance taxes. And they are sent to local jurisdictions based on their on the police aid based on what the local employer contribution is to the police pension aid, and the fire aid based on a measure of what the fire service area is market value and population wise. These combine to about $150 million for the biennium. There's also a smaller program, payments in lieu of taxes, that go to counties, townships, and a little bit to school districts that compensate local governments when land is taken off the tax rolls purchased by the state goes into public ownership to compensate them for the lost tax base and the lost development potential of that land. This is particularly important in some of the northern areas where there's a lot of land that could is owned, publicly owned, that could otherwise be a pretty could augment the tax base significantly if it were opened up to development. A lot of the lakes areas would be so that's a lot of foregone tax base in those jurisdictions. Finally, PERA aid is kind of a blend of a categorical aid and a general purpose aid. This aid has been around since 1997 when there was a benefit. PERA is the local government pension program, Public Employees Retirement Association. This aid program was created when a benefit improvement was enacted by the legislature that didn't have the full support of the local employers, this aid was created to compensate the local employers for their increased employer costs due to the benefit improvement. It is based on 0.7% of the 1997 payroll of the local governments, the para payroll, and this is a fixed payment each year. The benefit improvement still exists, so the cost that this was meant to compensate for still exists, but it is a general purpose aid that just goes into the general fund and is part of how they pay for all their operations, including PERA.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Mr. Blood, did we sign some contractual arrangement for this with cities that receive this aid? I think Duluth is one of the cities that receives this, and there's kind of been a question about whether the state has always met their obligation, and it seems to me there's been the city was under the impression there was some kind of a contractual agreement made when this program was created. Is there something more than just law?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach,
I
think you may be referring to some of the amortization aids that were to pay for the local police and fire plans when they were folded into para-police and fire. That's a little bit further along.
Okay.
This one was just a law that was passed. It was just another deal that was struck between the interested parties.
And Mr. Willett, you said it was not designated, that it's in the general fund? It can go
Madam
to the general
Chair,
fund?
That's correct. It is a general aid in terms of it just goes into their general fund. It's compensating for a cost that still exists, and the amount they get is based on what that cost was. So the reason it exists is because of a specific purpose, which is why I included it in the categorical aid category. But it really is a general purpose aid in terms of its fungibility when it arrives at the local government.
Thank you.
Starting in the miscellaneous category are the other pension aids. There are four other programs that provide state assistance to local governments to help cover pension costs. There's actually five, but one of them currently has no funding in it. The amortization state aid is the biggest of them. It's about $5 million a year, and it goes to pay the amortization costs of underfunded local relief associations. The amortization aid and the supplemental amortization aid and a third program, the additional amortization aid, which currently has no funding, are all interrelated, and there's quite a complicated flow of dollars from the general fund and from excess police aids, when there are some, into these aid programs that help fund the obligations of these local relief associations that have more long-term obligations than they have revenues coming in. And I think what Senator Bach was referring to earlier was when, in 1999, there were about 30 local police and fire plans that were folded into the broader para police and fire plan. And at that time, these programs, as well as the additional amortization aid, were much better funded because there was, when there's more police aid than what's needed to meet the employer obligations, those dollars flow through into the amortization aid programs to cover other pension obligations that exist in the state. Because since 1999, the employer contributions to the para police and fire plan have gone up because it no longer has a sufficiency, the regular obligations of the police departments have gone up, so there's no longer any excess police aid. So that revenue stream that had been flowing to these other local governments went down, and then eventually one part of it went away completely this last year. So I don't know of any contractual obligation. There was sort of a plan set out in 99 at the time, because the para police and fire plan had like a 23% sufficiency. It was thought that there would be plenty of extra police aid that would go back to these other cities to help pay their obligations. I think those obligations have finally been paid off. They had a 10-year schedule, so I think we're now done with all those plans paying off their unfunded obligations to the para fund. So I think that book is closed. But there are other local plans that still exist that still have unfunded obligations, and that's where these programs go to currently. And it's important to note some of it actually goes to teacher funds that are unfunded too. There's a cycle through to them too for a modest portion of these aids. Very complicated. I'd be happy to talk with anyone who wants to about this. It's kind of a fascinating little corner of aids and credits that actually does get plenty of review in the Pension Commission, not so much here in the Tax Committee.
I'm guessing that all members understand that fully now, and we're good to go. I'm guessing, Mr. Ouellette, that many of us have many questions, and we may have to start from scratch on that issue if we really want to understand it, and I will do my best to try and keep up with you.
Okay. In the interest of time, I think what I'll do is I'll just quickly list the other aids and credits so you all at least know what's out there, and then you can direct your questions to me as you have them, and we can go into greater detail, because there are a lot of other aid programs that are smaller but important. There's three aid and credit programs that are specifically for the Taconite area. There's Taconite State Aid, which distributes about $7 million a year from the general fund to local governments through the same formula that the Taconite production tax revenues are distributed. So a lot of that goes to local units of government for capital projects and for other purposes. There's also a supplemental Taconite Homestead Credit that is paid for out of the general fund. There's a main Taconite Homestead Credit that is paid for out of Taconite dollars. And that goes to a smaller geographic area. Then there's a supplemental Taconite Homestead Credit that goes to the broader Taconite area, and that is paid for with general fund revenues, about $5 million a year. And there's also a aid payment to a single school district that's about $500,000 a year that's a compensation due to a law change from 1978 that I can't recite off the top of my head. Finally, there's about a dozen or so other programs that I'll go through real quickly. The senior property tax deferral is like a reverse mortgage that's run by the state. Seniors whose property taxes exceed a share of their income can apply for this, so they can defer a portion of their property taxes until the property is transferred. It's a very small program in terms of the number of participants right now, but it's doubled. The number of participants has almost doubled in the last couple of years, so it is growing. There's also some aid to the Manoman City County and School District as compensation for when the Shooting Star Casino was taken off the tax rolls and put into Indian trust land. That pretty much cut the tax base in half in the city of Manoman, so this is an annual payment to compensate for that.
one of these.
There's also aid to counties with gaming, with to casinos that have a tax agreement with the state. So it's giving the counties a share of the tax revenues the state gets from tribal gaming to partly compensate for the law enforcement and zoning and other costs that those counties have due to those facilities, which don't pay any property taxes. Performance measurement reimbursement. This is a brand new program that is set to start. It was enacted last year. It's to compensate local governments who have a who implement performance measurements through a program that's going to be run through the state auditor's office. Border city reimbursements go to Red River Valley cities to help them keep their business taxes competitive with the cities that are right across the border from them. So it reduces the taxes on commercial and industrial property in the Red River Valley so that all the businesses don't cross the river into the towns across the river. Wetlands reimbursement credit is a tiny program, $12,000 a year for some wetlands that go off the tax rolls. I think there's only three counties. Disaster credits, the cost of this ebbs and flows with the amount of natural disasters that we have from year to year. But it's to compensate local governments for lost taxes due to natural disasters. Bovine tuberculosis credit goes to reimburses counties for a property tax credit to landowners who are affected by the bovine tuberculosis in cattle herds up. And it's the furthermost northwest four counties in the state who receive this credit. This credit will go away when the state is deemed to be bovine TB free by the Board of Animal Health. Utility value transition aid, this is compensation to communities that host power facilities, the value of which was affected by a state rule change a couple years ago that significantly reduced the tax base for these jurisdictions. This aid will phase out gradually as the value of those facilities grow, and it's already a lot less than it was 2 years ago. It may be mostly gone in a couple more years as utility values increase. There's a deduction from the county program aid that goes to the Board of Public Defenders to cover some of their costs. There's another deduction from county program aid that goes to two state agencies to track the costs of legislation on local governments, local impact notes. The political contributions refund, I'm not exactly sure why this is in property tax aids and credits, but it is in this part of the budget for whatever reason. But this is the cost to the state where you can give $50 as an individual or $100 as a couple to a political campaign and get reimbursed by the state for that. And this program had a one-year elimination last year as a budget balancing measure. And finally, tax refund interest. This is an open appropriation. When the department doesn't meet statutory requirements for paying refunds on time, there are interest charges. And most of this is when there are refunds that are held up because there's a disagreement between the department and a taxpayer on what the appropriate amount is when a taxpayer is in tax court. When there's an eventual settlement, then there's corresponding interest costs. So this also varies greatly from year to year, but it is an open appropriation. There's your whirlwind tour. I can come back as needed to go into more detail, or I'm available by phone or email if you have questions on any of these. We at the department love to talk about this stuff, so send your questions our way. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ouellette. My heart rate was elevated with you there, but I learned a lot. Thank you. I know there's more we're gonna focus on. I hope you can come back next week when we begin to delve into some of these property tax issues. For members, just to let you know about next week, on Tuesday we will have a joint hearing with Senator Roebling's Finance Committee on tax aids and credits. We're going to take up that bill in this committee, Senate File 60, I believe. Is that correct? Senate File 60? It is extending the 2010 legislative budget cuts going forward. So we will have that bill up in this committee for discussion on Tuesday. On Wednesday, we will have presenters on the issue of global competitiveness. We have a site selector who will come in and help us understand how Minnesota compares when you compare us to citing a business here as compared to other states. And along with that, we'll have some folks who are tax attorneys and experts about Minnesota's tax competitiveness. On Thursday, we will have that joint hearing with finance, and we will hear from our state demographer and from Dr. Wilson on tax expenditures. So three hearings, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week. Also, one other thing, folks asked for more information about the local sales taxes that are authorized across the state, and we had those that are currently active, and then what we've added is the information about those that have been authorized but not yet imposed, and also local lodging taxes. So that's in your packet as well today. So thank you, members, for your work on the tax conformity. We're going to bring that issue up again. And this hearing is adjourned.